LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain. But you feel it. You felt it your entire life. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you want to know what it is? You have to see it for yourself. It is the mental projection of your digital self. What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
What is real?
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Tom Campbell, who joins us once again to discuss his book, My Big Toe. As well as continuing the themes from the first three parts, in this episode we explore Tom's pioneering research at the Monroe Institute, hypnagogia and dreams, psychedelic drugs, levels of reality which have different rules from our own, the nature of time and the malleability of past and future, and the possibility that if we can finally let go of fear, ego, and belief, we too can access amazing abilities, allowing us to transcend the so-called normal three-dimensional waking state that we too often assume is all that really exists. I'd also like to apologize for the slight sound issue during the second half of the show. Well, Tom, when we do our final segment, which will be coming up in the not-too-distant future, I do want to talk more about the culture on this planet and our perceptions and how they all play into one another and where we are now. But let's continue with the theme talking about bending future probability. In the book, you talk about timelines and possible realities and the possibility that kind of everything happens in a way, but you and I as individuals in this consciousness are not, unaware of the rest of that other than what's right in front of us, as it were. And also that the idea that the past and the future are kind of accessible in a way. I mean, again, not being terribly scientific here, you can expand on this, that, and even the past can somehow be affected after the fact.
Yes. Now, that can be very confusing for people because they've watched Hollywood movies like The Butterfly Effect, and they've got this idea you go into a past and you change something and everything then on up through it to the present has to change. It doesn't work like that at all. The past is done. It's just a database. But it's a database like no other database that you've experienced. It makes Google database look very one-dimensional. In this database, all of the actors, which would be ourselves, we're looking at the past. Let's go back 100 years. If we want to go back to, or maybe just go back 30 years. Okay, most of us then were still alive. If we're older than 30, we would still be alive then. So we go back 30 years and we can look at the database. Well, for our own self, the data that would describe us 30 years ago is not just our name, rank and serial number, where we lived and some of the main things we did. It's every thought, every feeling, every piece of information that defined us. So it's a very in-depth database, and it's probabilistic. So you can look at, you can go back in that past, and you can say, I'd like to see, how I was 30 years ago. and you can go and be there. You can actually watch yourself 30 years ago doing the things that you did then. And then you can say, well, that's a show of what I actually did. Now I'd like to see, what if I had done the second most probable thing? You know, that I didn't actually do this, but it was the second most probable thing that I could have done. What would that look like? And then you get a different picture. It's a probability database. So it starts with the future probable database, which is everything that possibly could happen and the probability that it might happen. And then as that gets closer and closer to now in the moment, okay, the present, okay, then that turns into, as the present moment goes by, it turns into everything that we actually did. That's our history thread, plus everything we could have done but didn't do, and the probability that we might have done it. So we have these databases, and they are available. It's just database that goes with this virtual reality. They're necessary. If you're running a virtual reality, you'd like to know what's likely to come next so you can be prepared for that. And if you are running a school, you'd like to keep track of history because that's how you learn. If you have no history, you have nothing to base your choices on, how you do something differently. So all that information is kept. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect database. Every detail isn't necessarily there, but there's enough detail there and enough depth with enough different kinds of information that it paints a picture so real that you can actually watch it like watching a movie or go into it and interact with it. But you're just interacting with a database. So you could go back to you when you were 30 years ago and say, 30 years ago, yeah, that's when I met my wife. Let's say 30 years ago, and I just happened to go to that little store and I met her there. Well, what would happen if I didn't go to that store? What happened if I made the second or third or fourth most probable choice, and instead of going to that store, I went home and watched TV instead? And now you're looking at a set of probabilities of what would have happened under those circumstances. And you can run through the database and follow it out for, years or, however far you want to, knowing that the further you get away from the point, where you've departed, then, the rattier the predictions are, because you're basing, assumption on assumption on assumption further out you go. But you get a good idea of how that would have changed things. What your life would have been like? Did you meet that same person some other way? Did you meet somebody else? Did you not meet anyone at all? What was your life like? So all this data is available, and you can look at the future probable reality and see what is likely and what's not. But again, now this system has to do with lowering entropy, and we can give a logical argument if you wish to go there, but it'll take some time, about lowering entropy can equate to cooperation, interacting. See, all these individuated units of consciousness form a social system, and the most optimal way for a social system to reduce its entropy is by cooperation and caring. And I call that the love side of evolution. And a destructive way, a high entropy way of interacting is with fear. It's all about me. Am I going to get mine? And how am I going to get mine and make sure I keep mine? And that's a very high entropy. There's no trust, and there's only, that's kind of the warlord approach to social structure, as opposed to the cooperative approach to social structure. How we can help, and what we have to do, and kind of how can we help this planet, and have everybody move more to that love side of making choices as opposed to the fear side of making choices. Well, the number one thing to understand is that the only thing you can change is yourself. You can't go out and change other people. You can provide an environment that makes it perhaps easier for them to change themselves, by giving them, a place to feel safe, by giving them information, education. There's things you can do to help them feel safe enough to change themselves, but you can only change yourself. So given that, then the main thing that you can do to help this whole world improve is to fix yourself. Find your own beliefs, your own ego, your own fear, and get rid of it. As you get rid of it, you will help the whole get rid of theirs too.
Regarding your own experiences, non-physical matter reality, this is something that, in my experience anyway, of looking at your material, is not something that you talk a great deal about, and yet it's one of these things that people always want to ask about. You know, what was it like? You know, what did you do? Without getting into any of that, you know, if you're not interested in doing so as such, I'd like to say something about the experience in the sense of to give people a flavour of it. And this doesn't have to be at length, because you talk about restraints on experience and on action within other realities. And I think it's just so ultimately fascinating to people who might not have believed they've got any such experience whatsoever. To people thinking that, I would point them to their own dreams, for example, if they want something that's just mind-bending, evidence that there's more to, you know, than all of this in just the five-sense reality. But if you could just say something about it, whatever you think would give people a flavour of it, as impossible as that might be in a short space of time and with the limitations of language.
Okay, well, the way that I came to understand consciousness and write this theory down was not because I sat here in physical matter reality and thought about it a lot. I did that, but it's mainly because I could do research. I could do experiments in the non-physical, and I was trained to do that back in the early 1970s. I worked with Bob Monroe at Monroe Laboratories, and we studied consciousness for years there, and I developed the facility to explore this larger consciousness system whenever I wanted to and however I wanted to. It was mine to explore. So I used that ability to do research. This larger consciousness system is a logical system. It is repeatable. You can go back to exactly the same reality frames. You know, this our universe, I will call that just a reality frame. It's a virtual reality frame. There are other virtual reality frames, and they have their own logic, their own evolution, and they are, you know, predictable and repeatable and all the things that science needs in order to make logical inferences. So you can get into these databases that I talked about, and you can explore things, find information, check that information against, you know, known facts, and eventually you convince yourself that it's real. You're not just making it up. It's not just your imagination creating all of this, because you can gather information that you wouldn't know. So we call that paranormal information, information that is beyond the normal. So you find out things, you learn things, you see pieces of history, and then you can go look them up. So the first things we did were all evidential. We only did experiments that we could then check to see whether what we were doing was actually real. Was it something that was happening outside of us, or were we just making it up? Was it good guessing and making it up? So after a year or so, myself and the person I worked with generally was Dennis Menerick. We worked on this for enough time until we realized that it's real. The data was so enormous, you know, as far as the statistical significance of what we had done was such that you had to agree logically that, you know, it was real. We were getting information that otherwise we wouldn't be able to have. So once you realize it's real, that kind of then gives you the ability to go other places and do other things, because now you have a sense of what's real and what's not. You've learned to sort what comes from your imagination and what comes from outside of you. And that just takes some years to sort all that out. Once you have it sorted, then it's a matter of going places and doing things, doing experiments, going to the databases. And at first, I didn't realize they were databases. I thought these were like, the past and the future were all existing in other dimensions somewhere. But that turned out not to be the case. Some experiments then I did showed me that these indeed were just databases and that they were probabilistic databases. And eventually I found out how to work with them, you know, how to query them. There's a knack to that, just like you can get really good at finding things out of Google, but you have to really know the system and how to query it. If you don't, you have a hard time finding anything that you want in a database as big as Google. It's the same thing. It's trial and error. You learn and you get better at it. So these things are available. I didn't get to do this because I'm some kind of special person that was born with a special gift. I learned to do these things because I spent the time and the trouble to learn how to do them, you know, and all of your listeners can learn how to do things as well. But don't expect instant success. It's something you have to grow to. And the first thing that you can do to make it easy to learn these things is to get rid of the fear and the ego and the belief, because those are the three things that will keep you from being successful. The fear and the ego and the belief fills your mind with noise, with stuff that is not relevant, stuff that isn't helpful. And it causes you to not be aware of the information you're getting, to turn away information that doesn't agree with your beliefs, to not go places because you know that couldn't possibly work that way. And it's just very limiting. So once you get rid of your fear and ego and belief, you get rid of your fundamental limitations. So first step is work on yourself. Get rid of that stuff. And that makes all the rest of it easy. All the rest of it then becomes natural because you are a piece of consciousness. You are a chip off that old block, the old block being the larger consciousness system. And you have the ability to interact with that system in a very profound and meaningful way. You just don't realize it, and you have fear and ego and beliefs that prevent you from doing it or doing it easily. So, number one, get rid of that fear, get rid of that ego and those beliefs. And two, just spend a little time experimenting and practicing, and it'll all come together for you. It's not such a hard thing to do, but it may take you a decade to get good at it. Well, if you can't work for a decade before you get good at something, then it's just not for you. Your attention span's too short. But that's true of anything. If you want to be a really good pianist or play the flute or anything else and do it really well, it's going to take you at least a decade, if not longer, to do that. So this is a similar sort of thing. It takes time. Now, you can play a piano probably in the first 10 days of your practicing, but, you know, after a while you get tired of, Mary Had a Little Lamb and chopsticks, because that's really doesn't give you a whole lot of creativity there. But if you want to get really good at it, you're thinking decades, not even years. So work at it, and within 6 months, just like 6 months of playing the piano, you ought to be able to pick out a tune. You ought to be able to do something that's interesting, shows you that you have a little skill. You've mastered it a little bit, and it's the same with this. In 6 months, you'll be able to do some things. You may learn how to heal people. You may learn how to get into these databases and get information. Those things may come about in 6 months. They're really not very hard to do. So that's, as far as telling people, about the larger consciousness system, there's lots of virtual realities out there. And there's no point in me telling you my experiences, because if I tell you my experiences, you have only two choices. You can believe it or you can not believe it, because you don't have any personal experience. And if I put you in a situation where you either have to believe it or not believe it, I'm not doing you any good. What I'm doing is giving you information now that you will, let's say, believe. And when you experience these things, it may not be the same as me experiencing them. Because remember, we get the data. We may get the same data, but we will interpret it differently. We will use different metaphors. And most of what you get is in terms of metaphor and symbol. Okay, it's not like going to Chicago and, knocking on a door and talking to the people inside. It doesn't work like that. So I don't want to bias you in any way, because that will make your own experience more difficult, and I don't want to put you in a situation of having to believe it or not. But I can tell you that you will be able to do this. You will be able to convince yourself that it's real. And even if you're a real hard-headed scientist like I was, you can convince yourself that it's real because it is real. You just have to be open-minded and always skeptical. If you're open-minded, then you will try and work at anything. If you're skeptical, you won't walk down that primrose path believing in a story that you create in your own head. So that's the key. Open-minded and skeptical, always.
In terms of possibility and kind of belief, I'm reminded of in The Empire Strikes Back, and where Luke Skywalker is working with Yoda and, you know, trying to hone his Jedi mind powers. He's got his spaceship is stuck in the swamp, and but Yoda coaches Luke, and he manages to lift the... forgive me if you've not seen this, because it all sounds meaningless, yeah. But he coaches him, and he lifts quite a big stone, but he proves unable to lift the spacecraft from the swamp. Luke sort of saying, oh, but it's so much bigger, you know, and Yoda's saying, it's got nothing to do with it whatsoever. Luke was bringing the physical matter reality rules to bear, and Yoda was saying, they don't apply, you know, they don't apply, yeah. Really, ultimately. This is a very limited, you know, a bit like a thought of God, as you point out, or a thought of $1 million isn't qualitatively different. Well, then a rock and a spaceship aren't in certain circumstances.
Yeah, I think everybody's seen that movie. I don't know if there's anyone on the planet that hasn't seen that movie. I suspect there's a few, but most of them have. Yes, that the metaphor of the Force is very much very much connects with this idea that your intent modifies future reality. It's not so much a matter of whether how much heavier the spaceship is. It's a matter of modifying, you know, the reality, and you do that. You're kind of outside the rules of physics at that point, so they don't necessarily apply, and that can happen. But that's also very limited. There's a thing called the psi uncertainty principle that limits what you can do under certain situations.
Just to pick you up on that psi uncertainty principle, I mean, again, that's a whole other subject, as you say, but that relates to what I was saying about certain limitations, that outside of our own rule set, other rule sets have, that's the whole point, the rules and constraints are different, but it doesn't mean that there are no rules and constraints.
Yes. Yeah, the psi uncertainty is one way to look at it is that it reflects the constraint that you must modify things within the natural uncertainty surrounding them. In other words, if you've got something that has uncertainty that it can be, you know, it could be in state A or B or C, and there's some uncertainty that it's in any of those. It may be a 0.7 that it's in probability that it's in A, and a 0.5 that it's in B, and maybe only a 0.1 that it's in C, but there is at least some probability could be in any of those. So it's uncertain exactly where this, you know, what state it is you're going to find, and it could be any of those. Well, within that uncertainty, you can then move the probability to make it more likely to be a C and less likely to be an A or a B. You see, you can change that probability, but it's because that all is within the uncertainty of the system itself. So you can't say, well, there's a state D. That's totally impossible. It could never be that. You know, it can never be D. There's zero probability it'll ever be that. Well, that's not within its natural uncertainty then. That's certain. It's not uncertain at all. That's certain that it can't be that. Well, you're not going to use your intent to make it turn into a D state, you see, because that's outside the natural probability. So that's one way to look at psi uncertainty. It has to do with your ability to, limitations on your ability to modify probability within the given uncertainty of things. And another way to look at it is that what it does, that it limits an individual from doing things that would create a disturbance in the classroom, if you will, or a disturbance, you know, in the reality frame. So we need to keep the rule set as kind of, I don't know. I don't want to use the word sacred, but we kind of have to keep the rule set, not violating it. If everybody could violate the rule set however they liked, if you could flap your arms and fly or, teleport to China, do all these things, our world would start to lose its buttoned down, interactive, quality. We would live in a very squirrely, unpredictable place, which would then make feedback a lot more difficult and learning a lot more difficult. So we don't want it to be that way. We can't have things that just be impossible to be in state D and suddenly it shows up in state D. You see, now suddenly our science doesn't mean anything anymore because it can't predict anything because it's like there's a free-for-all out there. Well, that's not a good learning environment. So the psi uncertainty principle says that the psi effects, that is the changing, that what happens in the future probability, that's one place that we could call it, that there's limits on that. You can't just do anything you want anytime you want. You have limitations. And that, you know, it's just the nature. Now, that's not necessarily another part of the rule set. That's more of a policy of management, if you like, to kind of keep the schoolhouse working at its optimum and not to let it degrade to where it doesn't function very well.
Some of this, what you were just saying, reminds me of, I'm struck how often I go back to popular culture with some of these ideas, but I think that's just because I enjoy the parallels, but The Dancers at the End of Time by Michael Moorcock, and it's this far future, actually it's at the end of time, society that was become part of a trend becoming more and more advanced to the point where things became mental, not physical anymore. So it was the world of the mind is where things happen, but that could also affect reality. And this society apparently wanted this, but towards the end of it, it's absolute chaos. Anything that anyone can think of, creation, destruction, anything you can think of becomes reality. And it's just this churning chaos, and they just hate it. It's kind of be careful what you wish for sort of thing.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, our dreams are sort of like that. And some of the out-of-body states are like that. There are some virtual realities you can get into where the rule set is very weak, and it is very much like that. You can, you know, what you experience is often what you create. It's your own. You actually interact, kind of, you feel like you're physically interacting with the reality that you are creating with your own intent. So some realities kind of mimic that, not quite as dramatically as the one you described, but to some extent anyway, that's the way a loose rule set virtual reality responds. You do have a lot of power to rearrange and modify things with your intent in those realities because the rule set doesn't restrict you.
I've been fascinated by dreams all my life, and I've come to a conclusion probably quite a while ago actually that they do serve a purpose. Not just what I read early on is, oh, it's your brain's way of filing the day's events or something like that, much more complex than that. And even though sometimes they, as you say, in terms of a rule set, can be extremely weak and chaotic, and that can be everything from hilariously amusing through to absolutely hellishly disturbing and everything in between. But I feel that they serve a purpose, even if it's not always clear. And I think the more attention you pay to your dreams, the more I find you can influence them, but also the more you begin to see patterns. And I want to use the word meaning, because sometimes just like what you wake up and you go, what the hell was that? But I don't know, it starts to take on more substance in a way if you pay attention to it.
Absolutely. The dream reality is just another reality frame. It's another virtual reality that you can experience. And you're doing the same thing there that you do here. You are making choices. In your dream reality, situations occur and you have to make choices. And you get to, improve your evolution. You get to evolve or de-evolve based on those choices. It's kind of a learning ground, if you will, where you prepare yourself to learn to make better choices. And then when you come back to this virtual reality that we call the physical reality, you are somewhat prepared because of those dreams. You've been making those kinds of choices in a virtual reality where it's not a tight rule set, so the consequences don't bite. You see, the consequences are kind of irrelevant in the dream thing. You have this, you have this scenario and you react in it and you decide that instead of trying to save all the people in the burning building, you're just going to run out and save yourself. So you do that and you're safe and so on. But, you know, those are just, you know, imaginary people that are burning. You see, it's not real people. It doesn't bite you. It's just an experience. When you were in that experience, it seemed completely real. And you made a choice that was completely real, and it came out of your being level, and it shows you exactly what you would do, what the core of you is. That's the thing about dreams, is that all of your choices in a dream come right out of your being level. They're not intellectual choices. They're choices that represent the core of you. They're who you really are. That's the thing. And you learn by making those choices, and then you get to kind of look or think about it later and feel about it later, and that's part of your learning. So the dream reality is a very important training tool, learning virtual reality, just like this one is, but it's different. And the reason we need it as well as this one is because there in the dream reality we can do all sorts of things, because there's not much of a rule set that creates consequences. There's very few consequences, you see, because the rule set doesn't force consequences. Whereas when you're in a tight rule set where all the interchanges of energy that you make are all, you know, it's all interactive with everybody else, then everything you do has consequences. Everything you do will affect somebody else and affect yourself, and those consequences just ripple on out sometimes a long way. So the dream reality gets us a chance to test out and try and do and make choices where the consequences are very slight. And it's a wonderful learning lab. And like you say, the more you pay attention to it, the more you realize that it's very profitable. And once you understand that the situations you get into are usually just prepared lesson plans for you, suddenly you just happen to be in a situation and you have a choice to make. Like suddenly you're there and you live in this apartment house and you just realize that it's catching on fire and the fire's starting to, you know, so it's not like you were just coming home from a day's work back to your apartment house or something. It's just, you're just suddenly in the situation and you have choices to make. That's the nature of a dream reality, and how you make those choices will tell you exactly what you are inside. So if you really want to get to know yourself without that veneer of the intellect whitewashing everything and justifying everything, just pay attention to your dreams and the choices you make in your dreams, because that's you.
Related to dreams is the phenomena of hypnagogia. And I remember having an early thought when observing this, because it was just the sheer insanity of it, of the imagery. And the thought I had was, and this was in the hypnagogic state, so it was one of these gestalt kind of just thoughts, and it was, everything exists. What made me think that was because of the sheer kaleidoscopic variety of shapes, colours, mostly entities. Apparently, like faces are so common in hypnagogia. These things morphing at this incredible speed. And over the years, I thought, how often have I gone through a hypnagogic phase and had the same type of experience, maybe not type, but had the same experience? I thought, never. Every single vision, however short-lived, is unique in its own way. And after I read your book, I thought, well, this is perhaps, like, in my own mind, is some sort of, you know, analog to this big evolution system. You know, in my mind, my mind appears to be trying everything, because in my lifetime, how many hypnagogic entities I've seen? A billion? A trillion? I don't know. It's just... Anyway, that's a bit of a flight of fancy, but I just, thinking about dreams, I began to ponder the hypnagogic state, and does that serve a function? You know, why is that there?
Well, I think, my idea of the hypnagogic state, and for those listeners out there who don't know what that is, that's the point just before, just as you're falling asleep. It's that transition between not being asleep and being asleep. And for a moment, you go through this in-between stage, and that's the hypnagogic region, and you often see things. You often get visuals of all sorts of stuff. And my thought there is, I've not ever really found a lot of reliability. Like you say, they don't repeat You know, there's not consistency. You can't really find a logic to it. My thought is that it is kind of the random noise in your system, and you are trying to interpret that noise in the best way that your pattern recognition filters can. So what happens is that you're letting go of this reality right at that state. Before, when you're awake, you are processing data from your senses, and you're in this physical reality. And then just before you fall asleep, you let go of this reality. When you let go of this reality, you're no longer processing any sense data, which means that you're now just watching the noise. You know, like when you turn your TV, you pull your antenna off your TV and it doesn't have any signal, it just has noise, and you get all that white stuff across the screen. And if you look at it, sometimes you'll see pictures in it and other things. I think it's like that. Suddenly you're just listening to the noise, but your algorithms or your habits, your metaphors that interpret the data, you see, they're just grabbing at that noise, trying to make something out of it, trying to see pictures in it, like staring at that TV without an antenna and kind of seeing, you know, horses running across the screen or faces that come and go, and you can see other kinds of pictures. It's taking that noise and interpreting it and doing its best to pattern match it to things, but because it's noise, it's very random, and it doesn't ever really follow any particular kind of logic other than it's always random. And it's always kind of wild and crazy and fanciful.
Well, I read an article somewhere, the person was writing about this, and I'm paraphrasing now, but they said it's so often you will see horrifically ugly faces which are somehow really comical. I thought, well, yeah, that's the predominant experience I have. And I thought, what on earth is that about? And why should I have that in common with this other person? And who knows how many other people?
Yeah, I think that is pretty common. And, you know, if you actually linger in that hypnagogic state, which you can with some practice, you can learn just to linger there. If you linger there, there's no doubt that then you can take charge of it and do things with it in that state. You can actually start to impose your intent on it. But that normally we only have it for just a second or two as we drop from letting go of this reality to being unconscious in sleep. So it just lasts a very short period of time. But I think that's probably accurate. Probably most people find, ugly but comical faces there. That's probably a representation of our stress. The stress makes them ugly and they're non-threatening, so they become comical. I don't know. I'm just making things up, you know. There could be something more to it than what I'm saying, but it seems to me to have all the characteristics of noise and not much of the characteristics of signal.
Mm-hmm. Well, just on a related point to close on, Tom, I wanted to ask you about this and thinking about common imagery in non-ordinary states, thinking about psychedelic experiences now. You know, whether, you know, natural substances or, you know, artificially produced drugs, whatever it happens to be. I don't know if you've got any experience in this area, have looked at any research or what your thoughts on it are, but I'm reminded in that, those sort of states, for example, some of the DMT research that has been done, eyes and fire, a combination of fire and eyes, varies, and I've experienced this myself with LSD and other things. Very, very common recurring motifs. But on a more general point, I just wanted to ask you about the psychedelic experience and any relevance it might have to anything we've been talking about today.
Well, psychedelic experience, and by that I mean taking a drug of some sort, LSD or DMT or you can go to Peru and take ayahuasca and other sorts of things. And it's not so much whether they're a natural derivative from a plant or whether they're something concocted in a chemistry lab, but if you take an hallucinogen or you take one of these psychotropic substances, it indeed will give you a trip. You know, you will be blasted in, you know, out of this reality into, you know, another reality frame. But again, what you learn there, you may see things and it may be awesome and it may even change your life, because you may end up for a while understanding that you're just one with everything and that you're a piece and you feel like you understand and have the perspective of everything. You know, you're a rock, you're the grass, you're the trees, you and everything are one, and you can get some of these big ideas and feelings about how the whole system works, whatever. And then, of course, when it's done, you crash, and then you have to deal with the after effects of the drug. So what's the benefit? Well, and what's the downside? The benefit is that if this is how you get introduced to the fact that there's more to reality than physical reality, you get that introduction, and then you decide that you'd like to learn how to master this, so you go off and study and learn and learn how to do it without the drugs, then I'd say it has a good benefit. It's kind of, it's been an entrance ramp for you. It's like it's an on-ramp to a bigger picture, and that's probably a good thing. But for those who take it and they have the experience and say, well, that was really neat, I'd like to do that again, so they take more and they have another experience, and they take the drugs and they have lots of experiences, but it's not really so much their experience. Yes, they're manipulated in the sense that it's responding to their intent, but it's not doing that in any kind of controlled way. So you don't really learn much. You don't gain from it, because you're really not in control. It's more like watching a movie, something that's displayed for you as opposed to something that you understand and are doing. And that makes all the difference in the world. And one of the things that I think is very telling, if you read the book, DMT, the first book that...
The Spirit Molecule.
Yeah, Spirit Molecule. That's it, Spirit Molecule. If you read that book, you'll see that these people who went through his research process had lots and lots of super duper experiences, and they said these experiences were very meaningful and life changing and wow and gee whiz, and they really experienced the larger consciousness system and so on. But on follow up, they looked at these people some years later, and just to see if there was any kind of lasting effect that these experiences had had on them. Is there any way that they actually were changed? And the answer to that was no. They hadn't really grown up, changed, gotten rid of fear, gotten rid of ego, gotten rid of beliefs, and moved on. They were pretty much the same people they had always been, except they had this set of really fantastic experiences. Well, that's not what life is all about, having experiences. If you want to just have an experience, you know, go to the amusement park and get on one of those loop-de-loop roller coasters that turn you over a few times. That'll be an experience. But if you do that with your mind, with your consciousness, basically treat it like it's a roller coaster. You get on, you do the loop-de-loop in your mind, you have this awesome experience, and then you go back and get in line again because that was really cool. It doesn't take you any place useful. Matter of fact, it can take you to a place that's not so useful. I found that mostly people who have done this sort of thing very much, they no longer have the patience to do it on their own, to do it the slow way. They want to get there and have the thrill, but not if they have to really work at it and do it on their own. They've become dependent on that drug for that thrill. Now, it doesn't mean they're addicts or anything. It's just that they don't have the experience unless they take the drug. So they're kind of stuck. And the experience doesn't mean much other than it's a big gee whiz, just like a roller coaster ride. Yes, they've seen some amazing things. They've felt a lot of things, but it doesn't change them. It doesn't really change them at the being level. Gives them a whole new perspective, but most of that's stuck in their intellect. Not at a more meaningful, it's nothing they can use. They can't just take that information and turn it into growth for themselves, because it really wasn't theirs. It's like watching a movie. Yes, you can learn things from watching a movie. You can learn, you know, what heroes do and what, you know, villains do, and kind of learn a little bit about good and evil and how to do things. But watching a movie is not at all like living real life. And so that's my idea about the drugs. Now, I get a lot of mail from people who take drugs, and they say, you just don't understand. And I have to agree with them. I don't. I've never taken drugs to achieve altered states. I've never done psychotropic drugs. I've always wanted to do it under my own will and learn how to do it. So I was the one doing it, and then I could control it. Then I could always get back in the exact same state. I had repeatability. I could do research there because it was a controlled thing for me. Just like, you know, it's a controlled thing for me to go leave my house, get in a car, and go drive someplace and buy some organic fruit. You know, I can do that whenever I want because that's a process that I control. And going out of body and exploring the larger conscious system for me is like that too. It's a process that I understand, that I'm a part of, and that I control. And yes, I get many of the same things, you know, the feeling that you're one with everything and so on. I've had those experiences. They're there, but they're more meaningful if you get there on your own. And you can internalize them and grow from them better if you get there on your own. So drugs can be useful if they're an introduction, can get in the way if they're not, and can ruin your life if they go beyond that and you get to the point that, you know, you have to take them all the time. Now you become dysfunctional. So that's Tom Campbell's opinion of the psychotropic drugs, for whatever it's worth. But I comment on that. The caveat is I'm talking about something that I really don't have any personal experience with other than what I read and the people that I meet who have taken them and so on. So that's all my experience is secondhand.
No, I, for my part, I back up your experience. I'll just say, I mean, it's, I guess they're a signpost at best, but as they say, the map is not the territory. We're going to pick all this up again in the near future, Tom. But just as we close off for today, just throw out the website where people can find out about your work. And you know, you've got a YouTube channel as well, which is stuffed with resources.
Right. Okay. In case any of you who've been listening to this find it interesting enough to want to get more, you can go to www.mybigtoe.com, my big toe, all one word. That will be my website. And from there, you can look at media and go to YouTube, or you can just Google my name, Thomas Campbell, or My Big Toe, perhaps even MBT, which is acronym for My Big Toe, on Google, and you will get references to both my website and to Google. On Google, you'll find all of the interviews, and you'll find this one there, too, if you wait for a month. You'll find all the videos and workshops and things that I have done. That's, I don't know, by now it's probably 130, 140 videos that are up there. Some of them very long, some of them short, on almost every subject you can imagine. And another place to go would be to www.mbtevents. That will tell you where I'm going to be speaking or giving a workshop. And the last place to go is to the My Big Toe Forum. And from my website, you can go to the discussion group or forum. And on the forum, you can find a lot of smart people who can answer questions. If you just have a question, yeah, but what about this? This doesn't quite make sense. Well, go to the forum and ask your question, and you will get a very good answer there. And there's literally thousands and thousands of questions and replies. I probably have thousands of my own replies to questions that I've put there. So it's quite a reference center for topics about consciousness and other reality frames.
Excellent. Well, Tom, thank you in the meantime for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
All right. You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure, Greg.
That concludes part 4 of our interview. Be sure to keep an eye on the website for the 5th and final installment, which will be posted soon. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.